This is Y-Tune Shuffle.
Y-Tune Shuffle, it's the music that informs our lives.
The rules here are that there are no rules other than just bring in your music, hit play.
We get to pick your brain about why those songs.
I started doing comedy at the same time. And so for me, it was just like, well, you can follow your dreams. Like, here's this white dude jumping into a historically black genre. And he's just like, I don't have any apologies. I don't care. I'm going to be the roughest, toughest, hardest dude out there.
Welcome to Y-Tune Shuffle, a celebration of the music that inspires our lives, with your hosts, comedian and radio personality Maggie Mayfield, and Hollywood's secret weapon, David Earl Waterman. This is Y-Tune Shuffle.
When a woman gives her contact information in this day and age, a phone number, right? I don't know. This is maybe that you can answer this personally or in general. But I'm under the impression that if I call that same evening.
Yes.
That's not great. Or send a text. Like, here's a story.
Yeah, I was like, what's the circumstance?
So, through work, I had an experience with this woman that was purely professional. But during the experience, we were laughing and joking. And I left that moment thinking, I'm charmed by this person.
Yeah.
And I felt in that moment that I want to express that I just enjoyed this moment we had beyond just the professional experience.
Yeah.
And I was going to slip her my number with a note, and I decided against it. Well, it's now a month later, and this person makes a very clear effort to come up and talk to me. We weren't doing anything, you know, work related together. And I was just getting this, like, you're looking at me into my eyes and we're talking, and come to find out we live relatively close to each other. And so I do the, hey, you know, we should grab coffee. And she responds with this sort of what I interpreted to be the shoulders drop, the facial expression changes, and she smiles and says, that would be perfect. And so I take her number down, and about 7:30, 8 o'clock that night, I text, hope you had a good day, looking forward to have coffee. That was a Wednesday night.
Uh-huh.
By Friday at 2 o'clock, I'd not heard any response.
Oh no!
Or anything, you
That's
know.
That's terrible.
So I'm thinking to myself, did I pull the trigger too quick? Did I show desperation by doing that? And then I said, you know, I'm a 52-year-old man. This is not that big a deal. I'm going to call because I'm interested in having coffee. And
yeah,
do women think about like timing? Do you? I mean, is that something a man should? Or a person should think about in dating is like, if you're feeling the vibe and you're going to be the one to make the next move, do you have to wait 72 hours?
No, that's stupid. That's a game and no one likes games.
Okay.
I think what's happening is that, and maybe this is just me and what I'm experiencing, is that, yes, we all have these amazing little moments with people and we're particularly charmed by them, so you expressed, and you're enjoying that moment, but then you take it out of the moment and you text and suddenly you're like, well, this is real life. I've got kids and I've got a full-time job and I've got all these hobbies and these commitments and these things that I've got to do. What the hell was I thinking?
Right.
Saying that I could possibly start a relationship and not even like an intimate relationship, but a new relationship, which takes time to foster and grow. So I don't think that you were incorrect in that moment in what you were feeling with her. But I think maybe at 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night on a Wednesday, she was probably a little preoccupied. I'll get back to him tomorrow, wakes up the next day, and life takes over. And she just forgot.
You know, yeah. I mean, I can wrap my head around that. And I'm, you know, it's the life that we all live. But it's like, wow, I guess at 52, I still get that middle school kind of. It's like, when will that? Or maybe it's okay.
Because they're so few and far between.
We have landed safely, ladies and gentlemen, thanks to my co-pilot, the amazing Maggie Mayfield.
Thank you.
How was your week?
Good. Shows, this, work. I did a lecture on voiceover.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in that. Like, you went to give a lecture to who and on what specifically?
Sure.
And what happened?
How did it go? There's a school that I went to in Huntington Beach called the Academy of Radio Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen Sharp also famously went there. She does love songs on Coast 103.5, and that's how we became friends. And the school is amazing on so many levels. It's a very quick technical program. And each week, for it's a 30-week program, but for 24 of those weeks, you go through a rotation of lectures. And they have guests come in, big names, salespeople, program directors, on-air personalities, and voiceover artists that come in and teach you all about the different aspects of radio. And it's fun. It's a really cool way to network mm-hmm. with people that are already in the industry. And as a person who is doing it, it's a really great way to give back. And mm-hmm. the students, from what I hear, I'm one of the favorites that come in, and not just because I bring candy, but for whatever reason, I think I get more from them than they get from me.
That's probably it.
Because
that's probably it.
They're so excited and passionate, and I'm like, I never want to lose that spark. And you know, I try and give the secrets that I've picked up along the way in the past 13 years working in radio mm-hmm. and pass those along. And I'm like, I wish someone had told me when I first started X, Y, and Z.
And you got an enthusiasm for them, the students, knowing where they are. And I mean, that's got to register. And I think in order for anybody to really, the relatability, in order to say, I really like this band, I like this person.
Yeah.
You know, it's there is a relatability. I was in an elevator in Vegas with a very, you know, professional comedian. I won't say the name because it's not a very charming story, but this person's fans actually said to him, we were afraid to come up and acknowledge you because
oh, no.
we thought you would spit on us.
Ew!
You know, not literally. I'm sure they didn't mean it literally, but this person's act and this person's sort of demeanor. And I know this person very, 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 very well and personally and lived with this person. Totally understood where those fans were. Mm-hmm. And afterward, this person was, you know, stated like that was an odd thing for them to say. And I just wanted to say, sit down. Not at all. You got to understand what kind of vibe you give off. So, you know, the fact that you're appreciating your experience and audience, I love when I have an opportunity to share like that in front of people. You did.
Yeah. But it was cool. It wasn't so much about radio, but we did talk about that. It was more about voiceover acting, commercial marketing, social media, stuff like that. So
great.
Yeah, that was fun. Mm-hmm. That was it. What about you? How's your week?
Well,
what are you working on? What are you doing?
The whole phone number thing was I guess.
This
week, thanks to you, I'm interested in exploring not necessarily my stand-up, but kind of a hybrid of my characters into, you know, more of a stage presence. And with your challenge mic that you're hosting down at the Copper Still.
Yeah.
It's been motivating watching what you're doing on stage. And so I've been kind of resurrecting some characters that I have online. Busy Buddy, who's the guy that's always sticking his nose in people's business for no good reason, only because he's interested. And my drag character, Donna B. Reynolds, and my military character, and trying to sort of, I've got a plethora of characters.
Yeah, you do.
So trying to see if I can't bring together a one-person show.
My soul is singing for you right now. That's amazing. Ooh,
well, you're a huge part of it, Maggie.
I mean,
you know, I when we met at that improvisational comedy troupe audition, that was me saying, okay, let me get back into this.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm so touched.
Mm.
I'm really excited to meet our guest today.
Chuck Sklar.
Oh my God.
I mean, this is a guy who I met when he was young and doing just out of open mics and a working comic in the late 80s, 1989 in Boston. And Conan O'Brien, Chris Rock, D.L. Hughley, Wanda Sykes, and more, just a specials producer, writer, director, actor, amazing guy.
Let's dig in. Five, Chuck Sklar. Can you kind of go into how you guys met?
Absolutely.
This
is a funny story
is with Dave.
It's informational.
Okay.
Let's hope it's funny. Well, basically, I moved to Boston in 89. I arrived there on June 7th, 1989, 6789.
You did that on purpose.
That used to be my security code. It's not anymore, so fuck you. And then the Boston Phoenix was a newspaper back then. It was a free newspaper, wasn't it?
It was free, yeah.
And they had... This is all obviously pre-internet, like, you know, half my life and the the better half. And this show's on the internet. I love it. Anyway, I was looking for an apartment and I saw an ad. It was Lower Alston.
A suburb of Boston.
Okay. Yeah.
Was it Medford Street?
It was Medford Street.
Medford Street. it's hard to describe. It's unlike
working class Boston. A lot of what they call triple deckers. Mm-hmm. It's like three apartments, one on top of the other.
Did they have
like
a stoop?
Yeah, there would be stoops. Mm-hmm. And they kind of used to be houses, and now they were all turned in. Like, we lived in an apartment that was the top floor of a house.
Right.
Later, it had all been changed up. So, and I answered the ad, and it was Dave.
Me.
Was there, and then there was two brothers who were roommates. There was two guys from upstate New York.
Mm-hmm. Chris Kallenberg.
Yeah, and then his brother Eric.
Eric Kallenberg.
Yeah, and Chris was a chef. Great guy.
Still clearly in contact with them.
Not in contact with him.
Neither am I.
He liked to drink.
Oh my gosh.
Let's just say.
Chris was the drinker.
Yeah.
And Eric was the cyclist and the health nut.
Right, that's right.
Oh, interesting.
And Chris was a lot more fun.
Now, here's Chuck, unbeknownst to me, I set a spider web for Chuck Sklar that it was totally unintentional. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Chuck was established in Chicago.
A little bit. I had been doing stand-up like 2 years, maybe, maximum.
Well, you were getting gigs.
Yeah.
You were.
Well, I worked a little bit.
And Chuck was coming to Boston because there was a pretty vibrant scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, change of location.
Much better scene in Boston at the time than Chicago for stand-up.
Yeah. It was incredible.
Probably just starting to ebb as I got there, but it was still hot.
And so here's this four-bedroom apartment that is literally just four bedrooms, and then the rest of the...
And a kitchen and a hallway.
We're all on top of each other. There's no living room. Everybody lives in your room and then kind of passes by. Into the bathroom, which is another story.
It was like a rooming house in 1943 or
something. It was horrible.
Oh, my gosh.
Horrible. But I wrote the most fictitious ad, like bait and switch
in true
type.
Dave fashion,
I don't
sure.
remember what you wrote.
That's what got it, because it was third story, triple decker, charming location, two balconies. There was a balcony in the
front.
Right,
I remember your dad slept on it.
And yeah, my dad came by.
He bivouacked out there. Does bivouac mean... Camping, kind of?
That's what it is. When military term, it's a French term for being out in the rough.
Right.
You know, roughing it outside. But yeah, I, on the other hand, was in Boston because I followed a woman from college that I was in love with. Terry Goldman. Yeah, Terry Goldman.
I was thinking of someone else.
No, you then would pick up the story and follow all the different ones. But in any case, I happened to get together with a guy named David Cross and a guy named John Ennis and John Groff and a bunch of people.
Who are they?
These are people that today...
A bunch of nobodies.
John Groff is the executive producer of Black-ish or something now.
Oh.
Yes.
In any case, I kind of hooked my wagon to a bunch of aspiring young comics. And I began referring to myself as a comedian, even though I wasn't even doing it, really. I was just kind of doing improv stuff. And Chuck called, and we were on the phone talking a little bit about it. And then I was like, Chuck said, yeah, I'm a comic from Chicago. And I said, yeah, I'm a comic too.
Yeah.
And I remember that was sort of like, oh, great.
Then we knew David Cross in common.
Yeah.
I knew Dave a little bit.
It was pretty remarkable, you know, of all of the people to start rooming with, it was Chuck.
Was this the first ad that you had called?
Yeah, I think it was, because I was just like, all right, I'll live here.
Of all the people he could have chosen, it was...
There was an empty room with a window. I was like, oh, it's all right.
Yeah. Living the dream.
$325 a month, I think.
I think it was less than that. I think it was like $240 or something.
Kill for that kind of rent.
It was great. We had fun.
It was like post-college fraternal type living, drinking, smoking cigarettes, making coffee.
Watching Cape Fear on TV.
Watch the movie Cape Fear.
On the Movie Loft with Dana Hersey.
That's right.
Boston fans, if you remember that.
That's a good bit of trivia.
All right, so you got to Boston.
No, let's keep going with this.
So you got to Boston.
And then within about 6 months or a year, we were in a comedy group together, the Cross Comedy.
Mm-hmm, Cross Comedy.
Oh, okay.
Out of Catch a Rising Star. Mm-hmm. In Cambridge, and I was doing stand-up, and we were in the sketch group, and that was a blast.
It was,
and then you blinked, and then you're like, "I'm so famous now." It's amazing.
Yes, yes, I'm still waiting.
That's how it happens.
I'm still
waiting
for name recognition.
But. Okay.
However, in terms of resume recognition, you know, this Cross Comedy thing.
Yeah.
For every single one of us.
Yeah.
Was such a lucrative and amazing opportunity. And we were collaborating at the time with these young up-and-coming writers, producers, geniuses, Louis C.K. and Mark Maron. And then you and Louis worked a lot
together.
Mark
was in the group. Louis was not really in the group because he didn't live in Boston anymore, but he would appear when he was in town.
Mm-hmm.
Same with...
What was your watering hole? Where'd you guys go hang out?
Well, Ketch had a bar, and we drank for free there. So that.
Oh my God!
Yeah, that was one, and then there was Grendel's across the street that we went to sometimes.
The Bow and Arrow, the mm-hmm. Worst House, and then the show began to perform at the comedy, not the Comedy Connection, but the Charles Playhouse in Boston.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then there was another room I can't remember from WBCN. Mark Parento ran the room. Do you remember
Stitches?
Stitches. We went there, and then. The show started to go to New York and perform at Caroline's, and that's when we began to start to garner the attention of like agents and, you know, started doing commercial work.
That's great.
And you got launched into network television.
Well, I didn't really stay with the group past like the first year because I moved to New York.
You became like, there was a rotate, there was Louis C.K., Chuck Sklar, Ron Lynch,
people would
Rick,
come in.
Rick Overton. You were part of a like always welcomed, you know, member
rotating,
of the group. And the rest of us lived in Boston, so we kept the show going.
Yeah.
And then I eventually got a job on, as the comedy boom was really petering out. Because there had been like work. I was making enough money to live, by which I mean like $15,000. And then
a year or a month?
A year.
Oh,
a year. A year. No, no. 15 a month, I would still take that. That would be, no, I was eking by a living, but you know, and learning how to do stand up. And then I did a couple of television shows. I did Evening at the Improv, was my first one, and in I think 92. And then I did Caroline's Comedy Hour. And then it's funny because as I was getting these television credits, there was suddenly nowhere to go work because the clubs were closing. And Boston, they had this great scene. And then all these myriad one-nighters out in the Cape and Maine and in Vermont, New Hampshire. And they kind of just dried up because a karaoke machine replaced comedy at bars and stuff.
Yeah.
So long story short, I tried to get a job. The Conan show was starting. I tried to get a job there. I didn't get it.
Oh, you didn't get the job? I thought you got that. I thought you were the first writing staff.
I was the first season because I came in 6 weeks in. Mm-hmm. I got a job on the Bill Maher show, Politically Incorrect. That was the first season of that. And then I reapplied to Conan. And having now worked in television for 6 weeks, I knew how to write jokes that somebody might do on TV. Whereas I had no, I don't know how I got my first job, but I did. And then I got a job in Conan basically by submitting the jokes that I had been writing for Bill to say, well, here's the kind of thing I write.
What was the draw for Conan? Because you applied, didn't get it, and then you applied again.
Well,
what
was the Conan? That was a network show. It paid three times as much as the Comedy Central Bill Maher non-union show.
Got it. Yeah. So it's not like there was some magical thing about Conan, but it
was
more
about... Well, Conan did seem like a more interesting thing for someone like I was young.
Mm-hmm.
It was about... it was like the Letterman of our time, and that's what I always wanted to write for Letterman, and he had moved on to, anyway, it was, you know, it was that Louis was working there. There was a great staff, Louis, Dino, Stamatopoulos, Robert Smigel was the head writer. It was an amazing group of people, and my friend Tom Agna also had been a Boston comic, was writing on the monologue staff. Mm-hmm. So I went there, and then Brian Kiley came. He was another Boston comic, and we brought him in. So that was my first, I did the Bill Maher show for literally 2 months, and then I was running the monologue for Conan.
Wow.
Now, mind you, he did four jokes a night, so it wasn't like, I was editor of The New Yorker, but it was.
No, still, that's really cool.
It was fun.
And Chuck says, well, I don't know how I got my first job, but indeed, it was that there were some incredibly hardworking, sacrificing, I mean, I, for one, do not like to starve. And while I am arguably incredibly naturally talented, I could not imagine doing the work that these guys starved. David Cross, Chuck Sklar, Louis, I mean, they were always out like you are today, Maggie. They were hitting the, what we used to call open mics.
The open mics.
Booking shows,
yeah.
Having coffee, and I would hang till about 12 or 1, and then I'd go to my graveyard shift job.
Yeah.
You know, and I was kind of learning from these guys what it took to kind of do it. So it was hard work that kind of put them, all these guys working on this show had been working on the road for a few years at least.
Yeah, I would say I was obsessed with writing my act jokes, and for like 5-6 years of just, that's all I did was write jokes. I, you know, I also had shitty jobs. I worked at the Harvard bookstore.
Oh, that's right.
I worked at a place where you could go in and rent time on a laptop, on a computer. You know, remember how they used to have those? I guess Kinko's still probably does it.
Internet cafe?
Yeah, but it was just like it was before the internet because it was 93, 91. Hmm. You went in and just typed. And then you printed. You did word processing, I guess. And then, so I was a person there who was in charge, just sitting there telling people how much they owed when they were done. I said, you know, I don't really know anything about computers. And they said, that's okay. You're just, you know, logging people in and out. Okay, great. When something would break, I had no idea what to tell people. And then I got fired.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's like, I never know you had those part-time jobs. You then went with Chris Rock, and you've been with him for quite a while.
Yeah, so I did Conan for a couple of years and then did the pilot for the Chris Rock show, which was, I guess, 96.
How did you meet him? Was this something that you applied for, or did you wind up running into him?
I got lucky. I had done something with Marc Maron. It was a pilot called The Maron Project. It was a talk show in 95. And the following year, when Rock was doing his pilot at HBO Downtown Productions, there was a woman there named Nina Rosenstein, and she recommended me to Chris. And Dave Becky was at Three Arts then, and he was Chris's manager. And so I knew Dave a little bit from New York. So I went in and I met Chris, I think here in LA, because I was living in LA. I'd come out to do some weird show with Roseanne Barr called Saturday Night Special. It was a sketch comedy show.
Yeah.
You were on television a little bit back then.
I was, yeah.
And don't forget your toothbrush.
I was doing pilots, and I had a thing with TNT where I was doing red carpets and press junkets, pilots and stuff like that, yeah.
Anyway, I met Rock and Dave Becky for like 7-8 minutes, and then I was hired.
Oh.
Later, but it was like 3 months later I got a job.
And you've been collaborating with Chris Rock for 20 years.
And I've been working with Chris. You know, I'm still, he and I are doing a show now. We're producing a new show that's with a very funny female black comic named Janelle James. Do you know her?
Yes, I love her.
She's great.
Yeah. She's like my favorite person on Facebook right now.
Oh, she's great,
right?
Oh,
she's amazing.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
So I met her, I hired her for something last spring. I did a pilot with 50 Cent. The king of comedy. I had her come into a registered writer's room for a couple of weeks. But I had met her one time because I did stand up on her show in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did a good packet, and she was hilarious. She wrote an amazingly funny piece that was in the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sort of had a little bit of a relationship. So when I was thinking about somebody to bring in to do a show with, I thought of her, and then I got Chris interested.
Yeah.
And now she's on the road opening for him.
That's so great.
Oh, wow.
And then we're working on a pilot with Jax Media that does Samantha Bee and Amy Schumer and stuff like that. So we're going to make a pilot and then sell it, hopefully.
Nice.
So what you're saying is that you're very busy, and then we should get right into the music.
That's, well, yeah.
We can get into the music. I'm not, you know, I'm busy trying to get busy. I'm doing right now a bunch of things. Nobody's paying me.
You're like casting the net.
I'm developing.
Yeah.
That's the risk,
man. Like
that's the dues, is that you do so much work. But
Do you know a guy named Ian Bagg, the comedian?
Yeah.
He's funny. He had an interesting idea for a show, and we're writing a pilot just on spec. So that's
a cliffhanger.
Right. Yeah. And that's why, too, so we're on spec now. So you continue the journey. And thank you so much for coming down.
Yeah.
Music informs the show.
It does.
And Chuck has brought in his own 5 selections, some with a backstory, I presume. So let's get right into it, shall we?
Yeah.
Let's give it a little bit of a listen. This is Chuck's number 1.
This is cool.
You know this song?
No.
Oh, no kidding.
It's been ages since I've actually heard this. Just got knighted there, Ray Davies? He just got knighted.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, like this is the Kinks. It was a hit, and I think in the fall of 81. And I was a freshman in college. I went to NYU.
Nice.
You went to NYU? I never knew you went to NYU.
I went for one semester.
Oh, okay.
I didn't take a degree in law from there. I was there from the September of 81 to January of 82.
You heard this on the radio? Someone introduced it?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about it because this was a hit, and it was on the radio in New York on, you know, what was that huge rock station?
Not
was
like Fan.
103.9, I think, or it was the big station. It was sort of like the rock era was hot. The Kinks were a classic band, and this was like they hadn't had a hit in a long time. My first thought was this song. I don't know why. And I love the Kinks, maybe my all-time favorite band.
Wow.
At that time, I'm 18, I'm in New York, I'm depressed, I miss home, I wasn't ready to leave home. I just kind of figured out my shit in high school, like senior year.
Where did you grow up?
Highland Park, Illinois.
Oh my God, okay.
Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just really depressed. And of course, I'm in New York, and I wanted to go to school in New York. So here I am in all this possibility. And I was like, I can't hang.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. But that song was, I loved that song. And it struck me as I was thinking about it, like, I know there are still hits on the radio. Uh-huh. But nobody buys singles. I guess you download a single, right?
You download that now.
Yeah.
Streaming, that's more important.
Mm-hmm. But and I know I just sound old, but doesn't music suck now? Because, for example, I was in Vegas. So there's a song I hear. It's Raindrop, Drop Top. You know that song? It's a rap song.
No.
You know that song? It's a huge, huge hit.
Raindrop, Drop Top.
Yeah. And what Raindrop refers to is... if a guy,
oh my God,
is having sex with a woman, and then he decides to go down on her, so he goes down, rain. And then he doesn't like how it smells, so he goes back up in a circle that's like the shape of a raindrop.
Oh my God!
And that's what the song's about. And I'm like, that's not appropriate. I mean, am I crazy? And also, it's also a creepy sounding. You know that sort of creepy sounding rap. That's
yeah.
The normal. Sound of rap now, because I like rap, but anyway.
Well, it's like Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire, you know, had everybody spinning in their heels around, like, what is this voodoo sex romp? But there is something different. We've kind of lost all subtlety, and it's just straight out.
I think it's so funny, too. I love country music, and even, like, today's country, I love it all. But it's funny to me because the listenership of a country audience is typically right-wing, conservative, Republican. Mm-hmm. But when you listen to the lyrics, they're so filthy. There's one, Florida Georgia Line is a huge name in country music right now, and there's a lyric in one of their songs, one of their big hits, where he's like, I'm gonna put you on the sink and stick a pink umbrella in your drink.
It's you know,
it's like they're so subliminally dirty. I think it's hilarious.
Well, you know, country music is, I don't really listen to contemporary country music, but when I do, it's stories. It's like traditional songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate that. Rap is too, but I don't know. It just seems like that song, everything is like probably compartmentalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's no like crossover. It's all like, and also pop music has been taken over by rap. It's weird. Like I went to a bar mitzvah recently. So the kids are on the dance floor, as they will be. There's a DJ. There's a DJ.
Good.
It's every song's rap. It's a bunch of white Jewish 13-year-old kids. They're all singing along to the Raindrop Drop Top and throwing gang signs,
nice.
You know, like you do when you're spitting out rhymes.
Of
you know,
course.
And throwing great gangs. And it's sort of like, this is, I don't know, I just can't relate.
So let's talk about the Kinks a little bit more. So you were in New York, 81, 82.
18 years
old.
Did
you have a car? I mean, how did you hear this song? Did you
no, no,
was
I
a
had
Walkman a thing yet?
Listen to the radio.
Like on your shoulder, like walking around?
No, in my room or something.
Okay.
You were in the dorms?
Yeah, I was at Samuel Rubin Residence Hall, 35 Fifth Avenue.
Did you have a roommate?
Yeah, I had two roommates, a gay guy named Stu from Brooklyn and a guy that was like a Italian boxer from Italy, like a real Italian guy. He was a model and he was a boxer.
What?
It was a crazy...
You had a triple.
Did you tell him he was an idiot all the time?
No. No,
well,
and
for
I think
fear of being
the,
punched,
I think my gay roommate loved the boxer.
You
what
think?
A trip. What a... Three's and, company.
Yeah, it was like a pretty wacky... Because I later, then the following year, I went to the University of Missouri for some reason. And I was there for 1 year. I went two semesters this time. And my roommate was a nice guy from St. Louis. But I got to my room and he had a mirror. Remember those mirrors you could buy that would have like sayings on it? It was like almost like memes, but before there were memes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a mirror of Dirty Harry and it said, "Feel lucky, punk." And I'm like, No, I do not. I feel very unlucky at this moment.
NYU to Missouri.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a trip. Yeah, what did you think you wanted to be?
I always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I kind of think I secretly wanted to be a comedian, but who the fuck knew how to be a comedian? Like, you've started comedy within the last few years, I gather.
Correct.
So you just knew, like, well, there's open mics, there's mics to go to, there's classes at UCB to take. You know, back then there was, well, there was improv. There was, I was in Chicago and there was Second City, and obviously that was, and I went to a Second City class one time, and I found that very, it wasn't for me, running around the room screaming out things. I'm more of a, I'm on book. I mean, I can improv, of course, but I'm, you know, not.
So, you know, you knew you wanted to write. The secret comedy thing was coming out. Two semesters in Missouri.
Yeah.
And did you finish school? Did you graduate?
I did. Anywhere? Eventually. Then I went to the University of Iowa. Oh,
okay.
After I went to Northwestern.
Okay. Okay.
I went to Northwestern night school, I should clarify, and took some writing classes. And then I went to Iowa. And I finished at Iowa. I did 3 years at Iowa.
What would you consider your alma mater?
Iowa. Okay. Certainly. I was there like 3.5 years.
Cool. Wasn't it like a midnight theater scene there?
Yeah.
Like
that was cool No Shame Theater. Mm-hmm. Which had took over from Midnight Madness.
Yeah, because Mark Fite, I think, talks about that.
Mark,
and Toby.
Mark Fite, Toby Huss.
Higgins Boys?
The Higgins Boys didn't really go to college. But they were, well, I shouldn't say that. I think Dave did a semester and Steve did a month. And then Al Higgins, the youngest brother, probably graduated.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, a plug for kids going to college, whether you're going to go 4 years straight to a school or bounce around like Chuck did, or, you know, join the Army like I did and take night classes, whatever the case may be. What was happening at the time is that here's Chuck and Toby and Dave Higgins and these guys.
There's a lot of funny people that came out of Iowa.
Iowa. At the same time, at Emerson College, you got David Cross and John Ennis, Dennis Leary.
Laura Keitlinger,
Lauren Dombrowski doing this, This Is Pathetic improv troupe.
Right.
And I'm trying to think, like, there's the Chicago scene. And then in upstate New York, I'm listening to Dave Juskow and Danny, who I used to know as
Danny Vermont.
Danny Vermont. I knew him as Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito, you know, his real name.
Writing for the Bill Maher Show. All of these, you know, all of these things were happening in different parts of the country comedically, and then it all kind of coalesced. Everybody started knowing each other. It was absolutely fantastic when you think about it.
I didn't know that you knew those guys from upstate.
Yeah, Juskow and Danny had a radio show that my brother at Ithaca College call in all the time.
It's just mind-blowing that this was all happening and there was no Facebook. There was no way to know each other until you met each other.
It's true.
I can't even wrap my head around what you just said.
It was better. I think it was, but I don't know.
So the Kinks carried Chuck through during his formative years.
Yeah.
Throughout New York, the Midwest, Chicago.
Yeah. That's a great song. It rocks.
And our second selection, number two. See how amazing Maggie Mayfield, engineers this show, co-hosts this show, edits this show. It's unbelievable.
This is
the terrible recording.
Though this is a song that was on the Let It Be album.
Yeah, I was trying to figure this one out.
Hello? You don't know this one? Two of Us?
It's amazing. I've never heard this song. Never.
Is this from the film Let It Be? Must be.
It's from the Get Back sessions.
Okay.
This is the Beatles.
Does it feel good? You're like bobbing your head all into it.
This is a great song. This is the recording that's on the Let It Be album, produced by Phil Spector, and this with the Phil Spector Wall of Sound, is better. But this is a beautiful song. And it's about their friendship and working relationship, John and Paul. It's a great, you know, like, it's a bromance song.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful lyric.
Oh, now I know that. There's the hook, on our way. Oh, I didn't know the name of this song. I mean, it's just talk about Kinks never had a bad song. Beatles just such a huge library.
And I bought the album Let It Be. My parents had a bunch of Beatles records. They had Abbey Road. They had the one that had Octopus's Garden on it. Was that Abbey Road? Yes.
Yeah, no, I wait. Think so. No, not Abbey Road.
Excuse me. They had Hey Jude. Abbey Road, and Sgt. Pepper's. Those were the three Beatles albums that they owned. Three of the best ones.
What was the sound system like that your parents had? Was it like a big turntable?
They had a big turntable, Harman Kardon, as my father called it, a hi-fi.
Uh-huh.
High fidelity system.
Nice.
Daryl and Barbara?
Close, Michael and Ruth.
Daryl and Barbara are my parents, I'm sorry. Michael and Ruth Sklar.
Yeah.
And it was you and you've got a couple of brothers?
I had two younger brothers, Andy and Jeremy.
Did you fight over the sound system?
Oh, a little bit. Andy loved musicals.
Oh, and you're like, I hate my... You're
he
like
liked Wizard of
eye.
Oz, and I liked the Cars and the Beatles and Dylan. So the first Beatles album I bought for myself, though, was Let It Be.
Nice.
And it was like, I don't know, I was maybe 14.
How did you afford it?
I don't know, remember.
Just allowance money?
I was rich. I don't...
Like raking leaves.
Yeah, like raking leaves or something
weeds,
stupid like that.
Stupid
I did
stuff.
Have a couple high school jobs.
You guys had a house or a brownstone?
Yeah,
or?
We had a house. We were, because we were in the suburbs.
Oh, you're in the suburbs. Okay.
Yeah.
Traditional type family situation?
Traditional type family situation. My dad was an attorney. Uh-huh. My mom was an attorney.
Oh, wow.
And she still is. They both are. And they're doing great. My dad still is, he's retired from his practice, but he spends every day trying to get people out of jail who've been wrongfully imprisoned.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
He's an amazing
that
person.
Is...
And my mom is also still practicing law. And they're in their 70s.
Are they together still?
Yeah, they're still married.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yes, 50 plus years and going strong.
Well, they don't want a divorce because they both have the experience, I'm sure. Like, nope.
Yeah,
I don't go to
litigation.
Well, I've met your parents, and all of your family, over the years, you know, at different functions you've hosted, parties and so on and so forth. But musical household, I mean, your parents are the Beatles generation.
They're the Beatles generation. They were in their 20s in the 60s. So they were like a little late to be like part of the flower generation because my dad graduated Harvard Law 61.
Mm, okay.
61? No, excuse me. 63, the year I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And was, working in a firm downtown Chicago in 68 when there was the protests in Grant Park and the cops were beating hippies over the head and stuff.
Ugh.
My dad was at 6 North Michigan directly across the street.
Wow.
And I remember, it's one of my first memories, we're watching TV in Evanston in our apartment, and there's like craziness going on downtown, and that's when, Mayor Daley was like, shoot first, ask questions later, and all that kind of shoot to kill.
Yeah.
He said that during the riots. It was a pretty tumultuous year. The 68, and when Martin Luther King was assassinated, there was riots, and that's when Daley said shoot to kill.
Wow.
It's a sensitive guy. Anyway, my parents, they were definitely part of the 60s generation. A little late, though. They were squares. They were they weren't smoking weed and going to protest. But there was an interesting movie called Walk on the Moon. Could have been about my parents. It's Liev Schreiber. It's set during the weekend where Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, which was also the weekend of Woodstock.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And what it's about is a young couple, about 30, with two kids. They live in New York. They go up to the Catskills during the summer. The wife is up there with the kids, like the traditional Jewish New York vacation. And then the husband stays in New York and works during the week and then comes up on the weekends. So what's going on is they're young, though. They're not really like, it's almost like they're watching the whole world change. Woodstock, the moon landing. They got married, when they were 20. Mm-hmm. In 1960, and now it's 69. And then the wife, I think it's Jennifer Connelly, ends up having an affair with a hippie. The Catskills were in where Woodstock was. So they just, their life falls apart because they're sort of like caught in this, in between these generations.
Well, that movie explains perfectly my parents, married in 1962, and
right.
By 69, 70, they were divorced. My mother had married an African American guy who was just out of drug rehab.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it just, there was an explosion of identity and shame. Yeah. Your parents lived through it.
Yeah. People, as my dad said, when we were young, if you wanted to have sex, you had to get married.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that's not true because I read Kerouac, but, you were a sort of an outlaw. So
the Beatles is a representation of home, family, your first deciding, I'm going to buy this.
I love those albums. I brought them to college, and my brothers were like, where did the Beatles albums go?
Are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest, yeah. Mm-hmm. Then I bought the White Album. That was trippy. Mm-hmm. That was my next Beatles album purchase. Yeah. But Two of Us is a beautiful song, and if you ever, you should listen to it on the Let It Be album. It's mm-hmm. really...
I mean, was it inspirational? I mean, were you thinking at the time, the first time you heard this, that, wow, this is, these two writers, these two musicians, they're speaking to each other, and it really reflects them. And so is it fair to say this was inspiration? You were thinking in
yeah,
those terms.
Absolutely. And they were also, it's because, you know, the Beatles at that time, when I was a kid, it was like the mid 70s, the Beatles had broken up, of course. And it was seemed like a tragedy. Like it has a, you know, like a mournful quality.
Mm-hmm.
But the lyrics are absolutely beautiful.
I think of the Beatles and my best buddy, Bill Elliott, on a bus with a sixth grade class trip to Washington, D.C., him and I in the back, knowing all of the words to Meet the Beatles.
We, nice.
You know, it was an album that his parents had. They were both professors at Cornell. And we learned every lyric and just in the back of that bus sang
yeah.
it. It was.
Does that have the song, I Don't Want to Spoil the Party?
I can't remember.
That's
a
great one.
Yeah, it was my brain.
That's an early Beatles song.
Yeah, I don't
early
think
Beatles
that,
album.
Yeah, I don't. It was, you know, it was covers, Meet mm-hmm. the Beatles. It was, you know,
oh,
before
right.
they were really writing their own stuff. But the Kinks, the Beatles, the British Invasion via Chuck Sklar.
Yeah.
Chicago born and bred.
I guess, yeah.
Nationally known writer.
They did it upright.
They did it upright. And we're moving into our next selection, number three.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
He's a Columbia recording artist, Bob Dylan.
We'll do a live one.
I like this.
Yeah, this is cool.
I wonder where this is.
That's in England.
Does it say?
Live at the Grammy Awards, 1980.
Oh,
okay.
So this, let me tell you about this song. I bought this album. It was in, I think, 78. I was about 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his, he had a new album out. His previous album maybe was Street Legal. It was pretty good. I don't think I own that one. I had Blood on the Tracks, though, that was from 75. That's the amazing song, you probably amazing record. You probably know, Tangled Up in Blue.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so this was, he converted to Christianity, and this album, Slow Train Coming, was the album. And it was kind of like, well, you know, it sounds weird because it's all about Jesus. Like, what happened? Bob Dylan was Jewish, and he was basically, you know, a hippie,
uh-huh.
and now he's singing about Jesus. But this album is genius. And it kind of blew my mind.
How'd you come across it?
Yeah.
It was like, and there's a, you know, I listened to the radio. There's a new Dylan album. I went to the store and bought it.
Because a lot of times on Y-Tune Shuffle, people do talk about the family influences mm-hmm. or a person in their life that kind of shepherded them into a particular direction.
Well, I got into Dylan. There was used to be a folk music radio show that my parents listened to. My parents listened to the show called The Midnight Special. The Midnight Special was on radio station WFMT, which was the fine arts radio station in Chicago. They played classical music and opera. And then Studs Terkel had a daily show at 5 o'clock that he would interview authors and stuff. It was an amazing, still is, it's a great station. Anyway, my parents listened to the show, and then I started listening to it because I just thought it was cool. Like,
I feel like Tavis Smiley when I say this, but it's like, well, you're not only tuned in, but you seem like, as a young person, you were also tuned in. You know, it wasn't that you were just hearing stuff. I don't know.
Oh, you mean like very aware tuned, like, of what
yeah.
was happening.
I was curious. And I grew up in a cultured house. Like, we were always
yeah, exactly.
going to the theater, museums,
yeah.
film.
It's like a kid just cranking on. It's like, oh, it's 4 for Friday on, you know, WLLL, you know, whatever it might be. And that was a rocking song. It's like you were thinking about this stuff. It was, you were being impacted by not just the music, yeah. but the variety that came within that particular station.
Yeah. Yeah, so I listened to that station. So I got into Dylan, then I asked for a Hanukkah present. I wanted Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits when I was in eighth grade. So that was my first Dylan record.
So when you got this album, where were you?
I was 15 or 16. I think I had a driver's license because I drove to the record store.
What kind of car did you drive?
Oh, it was probably the Caprice station wagon.
Who was your best friend when this album, we got this album?
Mark Pechenik.
Why was he your best friend?
We've been best friends since first grade. Okay. And we were still best friends, but it was kind of ending. Because I was, it was kind of like on the cusp because, I don't know, we were just starting to go our separate ways.
Was he a Dylan guy or?
Yeah, I think he loved the Dead. Okay. And he got really into weed, actually. Oh. And I got into girls.
You chose wisely.
Yeah, that was the death knells. When we were seniors, I got a girlfriend and I was just like.
What was her name? Do you remember?
Liz Kennedy.
How'd you meet Liz
Kennedy? What'd you guys do together?
None of your business.
When you picked her up in your Caprice, like, where did you guys do? Did you go to the movies or like mini golf?
Well, our first date, I picked her up in my dad's Fiat Spider convertible.
Oh my God. Oh,
yeah. Sweet. Yes, it was a good.
Like, don't be impressed. It only gets worse from here.
Well, it kind of. I took her. Looking back on it, it was stupid because I took her downtown Chicago, which is like a 40-minute drive mm-hmm. on the expressway mm-hmm. to go to Greektown, where you could. Why did I? Now that I'm thinking, I was like, why did I go there? Oh, yeah, I know why. Because they would serve you liquor.
Which goes well with a Fiat Spider.
It's great for two 17-year-olds to drink a bottle of rosé and then drive a
Fiat Spider on the expressway.
There's this Greek wine, Roditis, and it's like ice cold rosé that goes down like Kool-Aid.
Uh-huh.
And, I think that to her credit, she drank about half a glass and I maybe had one or two. But it was kind of like a crazy adventure. And then drove her home. Good night kiss. That was it.
Was that your first kiss?
That was the first. No, but it was maybe like my second or third.
Were you dating? Did you become a couple?
Yeah. We got really heavy.
What would you? So you met the parents and everything.
Oh yeah.
What were they all about?
Her dad was dead.
Oh okay. Aww.
He was a major television personality in Chicago.
What?
Named Bob Kennedy, and he died of cancer, tragically, and in like 5 years earlier. He was literally had been picked. He had a morning show called Kennedy and Company on ABC.
TV
Chicago.
Show.
Yeah.
Local.
And he was going to be the host of the new show then, Good Morning America.
Wow.
But he died, and they gave it to David Hartman. Remember him?
I do remember. Yeah, that was, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm.
So I never knew him, but he was a good guy, apparently. And so that was, yeah. Her mother worked at ABC News.
That's incredible that your whole career is in television broadcasting. Who would have thought, you know? The two aren't connected, but
not really,
cosmically.
But we were in love.
Aww, young teenage
it was,
love.
It was like heavy, yeah.
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 Are you in contact
cute.
With her at all?
No.
Really? Okay.
But anyway, that's a great record, the Slow Train, about how the world's coming to an end, about how awful being in show business is, being a spiritual person in show business.
That's bad? You're not supposed to be spiritual?
Well, it's you're against everybody because everybody is like not so spiritual.
Oh.
From Dylan's perspective, think of it. Everybody in Hollywood is a boozy, drug-taking, ego-driven lunatic, just like now. And he was having a spiritual awakening and people were going, what the fuck's your problem?
I was having that weird thought last night. I was at the IOS Theater, the mm-hmm. Improv Olympics Theater, did a show. And as I'm walking back to my car, right down Cahuenga and Hollywood right there, I had literally just a couple of dudes right in front of me walking. I could hear them talking about slinging drugs. And I was like, isn't it amazing that in the same block, I did this really cool, fun show thing and mm-hmm. these hipsters are all watching and we're just sitting on couches and like making art. And then literally like on the way to the car, it's like, oh, the underbelly of Hollywood. Like this mm-hmm. is it. It was just a weird thought that this is all simultaneously happening.
And you've got Scientology there.
Oh, that too.
Wow.
That's ready for your next song?
I'm ready for my next song.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I think I'd like to go back home and take it. You know this one?
Yeah, this is every now and then we just have to just let it sink in for a few bars, a few lines. This is a lot like Drip Drop Drop Top, I think, in many ways.
Where does this bring you?
Well, the album is called Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, and that, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the name of the album.
Correct.
And this is the title song. And I knew I had to include a Neil song on this list.
Neil Young.
Just like I had to have a Kinks and a Dylan. And it's hard to pick.
Mm-hmm.
And a Beatles.
Everybody says. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to pick. Yeah. But I thought, and my first thought was Powderfinger. You know that one?
Mm-mm.
From the Back in Black, from the live album.
Black and Blue?
Well, it's the one where he, Into the Black.
Into the Black,
Out of the
yeah.
Blue and Into the Black.
Yeah.
So I think I bought this album when I was in college, and I had discovered Neil Young. I loved, you know, I had Harvest, which was great. And maybe even I should have picked the song Out on the Weekend, which is an amazing song. But I just like the message of this, because he's sort of, I believe this is about sort of that ennui of like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
What am I doing here? This is nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to go somewhere else. I don't know where that is. And that's what it says to me. I haven't analyzed the lyrics, but, and then it's got that very over the top Neil guitar riff that's great.
So I kind of sense that maybe you were at the end of college and you're like, now what am I supposed to do? Like, what are we doing here? Why did I spend all this time and this money and energy? And
right. Why am I
now
taking
what?
French?
Right.
I don't know. Because you had to take French. Why am I in biology class?
Yeah.
Because one of the things I did in my college career is I did only classes I liked. So then suddenly, with a year to go, I had all the other core requirements that I hadn't taken: foreign language, science, and PE.
PE.
And we had PE requirement at Iowa. It was like one semester of PE,
uh-huh.
I think. So I did 6 weeks of yoga and 6 weeks of softball.
That's amazing. I went to University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
Oh, okay.
And we also had that PE requirement. I took canoeing.
Hilarious.
Yeah. It was awesome. It was a lot of fun.
Where did you canoe?
In a lake. And
okay.
We were supposed to take this like gigantic field trip up to Chicago, but it was snowy and nasty, and they were like, never mind, you just get the points anyway. I was like, yes.
You were going to go canoe in Lake Michigan? Or
I don't know. Some river. Maybe it was Turkey Run in Indiana, if you've ever been out that way.
I haven't. I did go on a canoe trip once when I was going to University of Missouri. We went somewhere in the Ozarks.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I drank beer, though, all night.
Yep.
And puked then all morning. And then we had to get back in a boat, and I was like a wreck.
Yeah.
It took me a long time.
I served at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, and we got to go out to the Ozarks for an R&R weekend.
Nice.
One time. Very similar situation.
Yeah.
But Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere. That was how I was feeling. Literally the last semester at Iowa, I started writing comedy.
What's Iowa like? Like the town that it's in?
Iowa City is a great little town. There's a lot of writers, a lot of bookstores. It's also like your basic Big Ten school with frats and sororities, mm-hmm. football, but a lot of really good bars and the diner, the Hamburg Inn. My friend Eric from high school, his daughter Anna is now, she's a freshman at Iowa mm-hmm. City, so he's been back there. Some of the same places are there, like the Hamburg Inn.
The Hamburg Inn.
Really good burgers.
Those are days,
really
man.
Good coffee.
What was your first job after you got out of school?
My first job was, good question.
What, did you go back home?
I was back home briefly, but then I lived in an apartment in Wrigleyville, right by Wrigley Field.
Cool, yeah.
And I worked at Sam's. And my friend who I was living with had worked there, and he got me a job there. So I was behind the deli counter making sandwiches.
Nice.
Every morning when we would open at like 6, a bunch of transvestite prostitutes would come in and have coffee after
amazing.
A night out on the street.
They hadn't even gone to bed yet.
It was a wild scene.
Did you get to know them at all? Or
a little bit. It was a little freaky, though.
Yeah.
For me. It was like, it seemed like, well, that's a culture unto itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were nice. And I'm trying to get in with a comedy group, because that's what I've been doing at Iowa, which is writing sketches and having them performed by funny people. I wasn't a performer. I'd never been a performer, and I didn't really picture myself as being a performer. And I got hooked up with one comedy group. They were pretty funny. But it was like getting any group together. Remember Cross Comedy? They were the same way.
What were their names? What was the name?
The one person that I remember who was awesome was Ruthie Rudnick. Do you know her?
It doesn't ring a bell, but the name of the group.
Oh, I don't even remember the name of the group. I don't think I ever, we never did anything. It was like they broke up before we did anything.
So Maggie and I met in a comedy group that never really went anywhere. Anyways.
Yeah, that's funny. So what was the name of that group?
The Peanut Gallery.
Peanut Gallery.
Oh, I like it.
It was a children's theater.
So then I knew a guy who, I had a friend who had a friend who was a comedian. This guy's name was Ian Williams. Now Ian, my friend said, you should have lunch with Ian because he does stand up and he'll tell you, he'll help you. Okay. So this is my friend Blanford Parker introduced me to him. And Blanford Parker was like a mentor of mine at Iowa. Brilliant guy, Catholic convert, hyper intellectual, studied the classics in Greek and in Latin. Blanford Parker. And he's this brilliant guy. Everybody who's ever met him is like, oh, he's my mentor. He's everybody's mentor because he's just so, one of these people who is so, he had a very thorough, he was actually a very conservative guy, unlike me, and believed in Jesus, all this kind of stuff that I was just like, what?
But be my mentor.
He had a worldview and it informed how he lived and it, anyway, it's hard to describe, but he happened to turn me on to this guy, Ian. So I had lunch with Ian, who was like maybe 4 or 5 years older than me. And he said, I'm opening tomorrow. He says, you should try stand-up. And I go, maybe. He says, well, you know, it's just a good way to get in. You'll know people know you and you'll, you know, whether you end up being a writer or a comic, you know, it'll be helpful. And I kind of secretly wanted to do that because my heroes as a kid were all like comedians, like Jack Benny, Woody Allen.
Yes.
All that kind of like. So I didn't imagine, I didn't know where to go to do that. And I didn't know if I could do it. He says, listen, I'm opening tomorrow night at Zany's for Barry Sobel.
Barry Sobel?
Barry Sobel,
my God.
Who was a huge comic then. He was on Carson all the time.
Jeez.
And he says, I'm going to get you in to see me if you go up and do the open mic at the Roxy the next night. I went, okay. So me and my girlfriend, Belinda, we went to see Barry Sobel. Ian opened for Barry Sobel. Ian goes up. He's funny, funny guy. Then the middle goes up, this guy named Steve Segrin, who you may have run across. I think he lives out here now. But he was a killer Chicago act. He was filthy dirty. He was hilarious. And he annihilated.
Wow.
So Ian did well. Segrin annihilated. And then Barry comes up. Now, Barry's an act. He's from New York. He's hip. His whole act... He opened with a rap song, you know, I'm not the Beastie Boys.
He opened for Cross Comedy a couple times.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so he had a rap song about that was like a Run DMC song, but it was all about comedy and about how he's much funnier than other old Jewish comics like Shecky Green. It was very like, who's this for? Me. As it turned out. Like, I'll tell you who it wasn't for, the audience at Zany's on Wells in Chicago. Because this was like a comedy club that had existed before the comedy boom, like since the mid-70s. I don't know, like white, blue collar is how I would describe the audience. And there's Barry going up there, and he's rapping. By the way, rap at this point was just like something that you heard about that black people did that was not in the mainstream. I think the Beastie Boys had just had their first hit, you know, Fight for Your Right to Party, like that, the year before.
Liza
My name
Dale.
Is Mike D.
Yeah, Liza
yeah.
Dale.
Every song.
But so he's up there. He's doing this thing. It's kind of a, you know, there's music. He's rapping. It's funny. But they don't get the jokes. And he's putting out tons of energy and not getting anything back. But the amazing thing was he didn't give a shit. He was bombing. He didn't care. Then he did some bits and then they killed. Hilarious bits, but then he had other bits that were just, they didn't care about him. He had a lot of material for some reason about soul music. He was the one white comic who was on Evening at the Apollo, or maybe Eddie Murphy had him in a special. I don't remember, but he had a real connection to black culture. And I just was amazed, like, because we were dying, me and my girlfriend were laughing. The audience, a few chuckles, and some things they loved. That's the thing is, he's so great, then he would just go, well, I'll just do that thing that I know was going to kill, and he would kill. And then he would go back and do something that seemed like it was more what he really wanted to talk about. And he had the famous bit about my father, we'd go to a steakhouse, and they put a big basket of bread out, and my father would say, don't eat that bread. Don't eat that bread, because then your steak's going to come. You're going to eat all. You're going to eat a loaf of bread. You're not going to be hungry. You have the steak. That's how they get you. That's how they get
that's
you.
That's how they
was,
get you.
That
that's
was his one of his callbacks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, sure, Dad. I'm sure they're taking the steaks back in the back room, sawing off the part that we bit in, and reselling them to people. I'm sure that's their master plan. Something like that. Anyway, so I walked out of this show where I'd seen Ian, Steve Segrin, Filthy Dirty, Annihilate, and then Barry, who was like another level of an artist who kind of didn't do that well, but didn't give a shit. And yeah. I was just like, I'm not doing stand-up. This is bullshit. I can't do that. And my girlfriend says, oh, you can do it. You'll just do your version of what the hell they did. You know, don't even.
Wow.
And so the next night, I spent all day writing jokes. You know,
The night of your first gig.
I'm writing jokes. And I had, of course, some jokes, some mm-hmm. things that I had thought of before. So, you know, I could put 10 minutes together. You got 10 minutes at this place.
Wow.
You drew numbers. I drew like 6th or 7th. I had a really good spot.
That was a really good spot.
Really good spot. There was music and comedy, sketches, performance art. There was this group called Jazz Poetry Truth. And then also Andy Dick and Dino Stamatopoulos had a comedy team, Andy and Dino, and they were on the show too.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
And that's how I met them there. So, okay, so I go up and I kill. I fucking rocked it because I don't know why, but I just, you know, it was funny. It was also a very receptive audience, and I was also in a good spot. But it was like almost the worst thing that could have happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I just thought I was like, oh my God, I'm like as funny as Steve Segrin and Ian and Barry. So I'm like, okay, I'm a comedian. No. So then the following week, I go back to the same open mic. I draw a number, 18 or 19. So then instead of going on at
early
9:45, I'm going on at 1.
Yeah.
Still an audience there, a little bit of an audience. I go up, I'm doing the same material they killed the week before, nothing. Oh. It's getting nothing. I can't even believe it.
Yeah.
I can't even believe it. You know, I'm like, I'm sweating, like sweat's just coursing down my every pore. So,
oh,
it was, that was how I started.
Oh, wow. Man. Jeez.
But I rebounded from that one.
Well, I would say so, yeah. Well, and you stuck with it. You just started driving up and down.
One of the craziest things that ever happened to me, it was a few years later, I was in New York. I'm at the Boston Comedy Club on West 3rd Street, and a young kid from Baltimore comes in. He's a young black kid. His name's Dave Chappelle.
Oh my God.
I'm supposed to go on, but he goes on ahead of me because I think he was being managed by the club manager, the club owner, Barry.
Mm-hmm.
So he's funnier than anybody I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He kills. He doesn't just kill. It's sort of like you felt like you just saw somebody great.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a buzz and excitement.
Mm-hmm.
He did like 15 minutes. He's also like, just like he is now, he's slow.
Mm-hmm.
He talks. He takes his time. It wasn't like he doesn't seem like he was trying. He just was like at another level.
Yeah.
And I go up. The crowd is, they're all talking and like, what do we just see? This is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm eating it just like can't. And I was pretty good by this point. I had my 10, 15, 20 minutes that I knew would reliably work. I am just eating it, and I get off the stage and I'm like, I'm gonna quit. I'm like, I can't follow this child that shows up from Baltimore. That's bullshit. I'm really like spending 24 hours thinking, you know, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I need to do something else. I don't know. I'm just depressed. And so then I'm at the Comedy Cellar the next night. I have a spot, and I'm about to go on, and who walks in? Dave Chappelle.
Stop it.
He's bumping me.
Stop
and he's
it.
Like, nobody knew this guy 24 hours ago. Now he's getting on. He's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
He goes on. He's Dave Chappelle. He does great.
Yeah.
He's amazing. I'm thinking, all right, this is it. I'm not bombing.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen in this set, but I am not going to just eat it. I didn't have a lot of gears to go to. So now I'm like, I go up there. I don't think that I started improving, but I just was like, I'm doing my material and they're going to hear it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had a good set. Didn't kill, wasn't Chappelle, but you know, I was like, Okay, I can now...
You can follow Dave Chappelle.
I can at least not utterly humiliate myself.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, stand-up comedy. Oh,
but
my God.
But following somebody so amazing is like following...
Pro. You got to be a pro.
Yeah.
You got to be a pro.
Just keep going. We have one more song.
That's it? One more?
Yeah.
This is the...
Dang it.
This is the outlier. You guys know this tune?
Heck yeah, I do.
Well, you said, yeah.
Well, we play it on my station.
Uh-huh. The Ghost.
I was in high school when I started getting into this. It was obviously not the 80s, but my girlfriends and I would drive around drinking Diet Coke and we would go have sushi and we were like, oh, I love everything 80s. It's like before the 80s were cool again.
Oh, man, this is club.
Now, why do I like this song?
Yeah, because I'm thinking what a it's
not,
a diversion.
Not me at all,
from.
But I was doing karaoke one time. I was at a party, like a rap party for a show, and everybody was doing karaoke, and they were like, we're signing you. I'm like, I'm not doing karaoke. I don't like karaoke. I don't want to hear you do karaoke. And I'm sure as hell not doing karaoke because it's stupid. I can't sing and you can't sing and it's awful. It's a horrible.
That's the point of karaoke, I thought.
Apparently. Now, some people can sing and that's fine, but most people can't. So they signed me up for a song and they're like, and I was like running the show, but my staff was great and they were like, you're not leaving until you do a song. And I was like, I put my coat on and I was walking out the door like at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they're like, no. It was like three women. They're like, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And then I have the mic and so that was a song. I was like, oh, I can actually sing this.
Yeah.
Because it's a funny way of talking. Like,
yeah.
It's like a gay vampire kind of. Like Boris Karloff.
That's so great.
That's like zombie, English zombie singing.
Yeah.
Like The Cure. I like The Cure, too. The Cure is a great band. Depeche Mode, this song, I just happen to be like, so if I'm ever at a karaoke, that's what I
this
will.
This is your go-to karaoke song.
Yes.
Good to know.
It's
my
funny.
Go-to karaoke is Blondie, Call Me.
Oh, that's a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is... I don't know why sometimes I get frightened.
Who's
I got
that
you.
By?
I can never remember who the band is by, but it's I Got You, That's All I Want. You know? It's all about a guy who's super obsessed with his girlfriend and manic about go out. I don't know, you know. It's just, so I was trying to find it, actually. I was listening to it as I bicycled over here.
Everything I wanted, everything I needed is here in my arms.
You sound just like him.
Shut up.
Here's a guy who's got to follow Dave Chappelle and kill, but I'm not getting on to karaoke.
Nope,
y'all think comedians are just naturally want to be on stage and naturally want to do stuff. Not so much. No.
My friends and I did an improv troupe, and we would play, this stupid game called Scaryoke. So we would never know what we were singing. We would just sign each other up. The worst, but the best. So fun.
Yeah.
Well, now that we've gone through your fave five, we've got a couple other interesting questions for you. Okay, so this is my favorite part of the show.
Okay, cool.
I call it your guilty pleasure song, the thing that if your friends knew you were listening to this right now, you'd be kind of mortified. So for me, my guilty pleasure is Justin Bieber.
Uh-huh.
But I'll say it proudly. I don't care. I'm not sorry.
Which song?
Is it too late now to say sorry? Nope.
I think that was a good song.
It is a good
song. I
agree.
That was a good songwriting.
People do come out when you mention it. Like I have an aunt that just came out as a Belieber.
Nice.
Yeah. Sure. I'm not. I just happen to know that song. It's a good song.
Yeah.
I don't know why I would feel guilty about this. I guess it's just it's incongruous. My friends might make fun of me, but I think Adele is amazing.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think that's. That's far from controversial.
Hello.
No, but we started the show with music's not that great these days.
Yeah.
And you sort of have to kind of wade
well,
your way
I
into
think
it.
About it.
It's saturated. That's what the problem is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it always will be saturated.
No, she's amazing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine's always been gospel music, like traditional gospel, not Southern, soul gospel, like the gospel brunch, but just Christian songs. I don't identify with
that's
any
embarrassing
religion.
David.
I will. It's my guilty pleasure.
it's funny that you're guilty about something that's pure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. Because
you better go confess.
I'm pretty agnostic, and I can, bordering on atheism, and I question all of that stuff. So the fact that I actually get turned on by these old Rugged Cross songs is a guilty pleasure I have. Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lyric, like a line. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of what mine is, and I saw this on a T-shirt when I was actually at my third AC/DC concert in 3 decades. Mm-hmm. There's a T-shirt that they
sell. Stop bragging.
Sorry, AC/DC. Going down, party time, my friends are going to be there too, is one of the greatest lines of music. That.
What song is that from?
Yeah.
I'm on a highway to hell.
A lyric that sticks
with you? A
lyric,
yeah, like a line. From a song. I know I'm just springing it on you.
I have two.
Well, hit one.
Well, I used to own this. There's a band called Eve Six. I was into like the pop punk in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Eve Six, and they did the song, they tie me to the bedpost. My mother hated me wearing that shirt.
Why? Why?
Like,
I wonder.
Tie me to the bedpost. Yeah. Whatever.
I think I vaguely remember that song.
Yeah. Tie me to the bedpost. Yeah.
The thing that jumps to mind, The Replacements have a song. She opens her mouth to speak, and what comes out's a mystery. Thought about, not understood, she's aching to be.
Nice.
Yeah, right? I mean, yeah. The lyric, yeah. Particularly.
That's something that I think as anybody who is an artist, a writer, a comedian can relate to that. Probably a person. You want to become you, and you don't know how.
Yes.
That's what the song is about.
Ba-ding.
That's good.
And it's that's why that song is touching.
You're speaking to my soul right now. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For the last part of the show?
Yes.
Yes. Which is my favorite part. Talk about your very first concert ever.
Oh. Wow.
That's my favorite reaction, I think, yet.
I love the pause. People have to kind of laugh.
I have a really good one.
Oh, all great. Right.
I'm just making sure that this is... I mean, I went to things with like my parents when I was a kid.
Sure, yeah, anything goes, but you know, but.
But when I think of my first concert, 1978, The Who,
nice.
Ooh, wow. Chicago Amphitheater,
nice.
And I went with Brad Pickard.
Brad Pickard,
yes.
Who drove?
I drove the station wagon.
Nice.
78 was the big tour. That was the Danger tour.
Well, there was in Cincinnati or Cleveland, there was the people that were...
It was Cleveland.
Cleveland. Yeah. They were trampled. Four people were killed the week before.
Just the week before.
Just the week before.
Wow.
Oh, man.
This was the Who Are You tour, which is an amazing fucking record.
I woke up in a Soho doorway. A policeman knew my name.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I wrote that to a girlfriend. Yeah. The last
They stole it from you.
Yeah.
And, you know, Keith Moon had died earlier that year, I think. It was late in the year. And they had their new drummer. I think it was Kenny Jones. Mm. But my mom had a college roommate named Ina Mybeck. She was a famous show business attorney, particularly for rock musicians in New York. Her clients were... people like The Who, Billy Joel, Leonard Skinner, Monty Python's Flying Circus. She was the coolest person we knew growing up.
Yeah.
Like, we went to New York once, and then she took us to lunch at the Russian Tea Room.
Oh, wow.
And she was like, there's Woody Allen. There's Bob Fosse. It was kind of, this was like 76.
Oh, it's incredible, man.
It was crazy.
Great New York. Yeah. Great period of time, New York.
Crazy story. So there's Martin Scorsese. We're like, who's that? Anyway. So... she got us tickets. So the first thing we did is we drove to the Whitehall Hotel in the Loop, which you would now call a boutique hotel, but was then just like some fancy little place.
Yeah.
And that's where they were staying, apparently. We were picking up our tickets at the front desk. So I got the tickets, and my friend waited in the car, came back out. I had the tickets. I opened them up, first row.
Jeez.
Wow. Jeez. No big deal.
So... the amphitheater's on the south side. We're in the Loop, north side. Never really go to the south side. The only time I've been there to go to the amphitheater was when I was a kid and went to the circus. The plan is it's at Halsted and something south. So we're driving. I know where Halsted is because that's where Greektown is. Mm-hmm. So I'm driving west on some street like Jackson. or Adams, one of the president streets, to hit Halsted, take a left, and then go to the amphitheater. We miss Halsted. We drive and drive and drive about a half hour, a really long time. I don't know how long. It probably seemed like a half hour, and it was maybe 15, 20 minutes. But we're suddenly in what I now know is the West Side Ghetto. We are in one of the scariest neighborhoods I've ever seen. It's like burnt out cars,
wow,
buildings, people on the street. It was very scary. And we're like, this isn't right. We missed the turn. Okay, we go back. We find Halsted. We get to the amphitheater. We're thinking, like the show says, you know how concerts are. It says it starts at 8, or the doors open at 8. The show's supposed to start at 9. The opening act goes on at 10.
Right.
The Who go on at 11:30. That's right. What happened. So we got there. There wasn't even, like, you know, I think White Snake opened.
Wow. White Snake, whoa.
Like some metal act.
That's crazy.
It is kind of weird. And they weren't even on yet. You know, we got there. My parents had two friends, Dick and Ellie Kalish, who were also huge rock fans. And they were there. They also had got tickets. And they were like, where have you been? We were worried. But we're not in the front row right at the stage. We're on the front row. We're by the front of the stage, but you know how there's like, here's the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're to the side, you're sort of looking that way.
Yeah, kind
of. So we were, but angled. We had amazing seats because you're above everybody.
Yeah.
Looking right at the act.
So it wasn't like general admission. Like, yeah. It's not like you were standing.
No. Yeah. We had seats.
So
and
cool.
It was mm-hmm. amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was all that, like, you know, that microphone twirling that Daltrey does, and the windmill, Townsend's windmill guitar.
Yeah.
It was an amazing show.
Wow.
And it was the Who.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
absolutely the loudest thing I've ever heard.
It's been ages since I've been to a big arena show, but the ears ring for days afterwards, you know, just unbelievable. Yeah.
So that was some experience.
Jeez. Oh, having you... It's been amazing. Corner of the internet?
Happy to do it. This is fun.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. Well, hey, so for all of our millions of listeners out there, what's your corner of the internet? How do we find you? What are you working on? Anything exciting that you want to promote?
Good question. Like I said, I'm doing a pilot with Janelle James, but we haven't made it yet, so we don't know where it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nowhere to say. There's nowhere to, you know.
You don't have a website?
Do you have a website or do you like Twitter?
I am at Twitter. I am Chuck_Sklar. I don't really do Twitter, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
I should, though, right?
No.
It's Instagram, it's Twitter, and Facebook. You know?
You don't have to.
Instagram, I'm Sklarface1. Sklarface1.
Cool.
And I'm on Facebook.
We'll stalk and obsess over you on Instagram. It'll be amazing.
All right.
He's what like, a treat.
Thank you. This has been awesome.
I'm glad. It's been fun. I'm now having some regrets about my song choice.